There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
It's almost Election Day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, COTA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, COTA Mainstream, or COTA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at COTA.com.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I am Charlie Sykes. It is Wednesday. Tomorrow, of course, will be the big primetime hearing of the January 6th committee, and there is evidence that it's having a cumulative effect. We will talk about that also. In case you were looking for more data points about the level of insanity in the Republican Party, we are getting fascinating stories. Out of Arizona, Wisconsin, and Maryland. So let's start there with our guest, my colleague, Bill Kristol, who joins us again. Thank you so much, Bill, for coming on the podcast.
Happy as always to be with you, Charlie.
Okay, let's talk about Maryland. I have here the Vice News story. A man who organized buses to Washington on January 6th tweeted during the Capitol riot that Vice President Mike Pence was a traitor, tried to impeach Maryland Republican Governor Larry Hogan over his actions to stem COVID, and spoke at a QAnon conference this spring, just won the Republican nomination for Maryland governor. Now, you think I'm going to stop there, right? But they go on. And he's not even the most extreme candidate Maryland Republicans nominated for statewide office on Tuesday. His coattails helped his friend and ally, Michael, was it Perutka? A Christian nationalist and former board member of the neo-Confederate secessionist League of the South, whose extreme views are almost too numerous to enumerate, win the GOP's nomination for attorney general. And in something of an understatement, they write, their wins show how radicalized and conspiracy theory-minded a significant segment of the Republican base has grown in response to COVID and Trump's lies about the 2020 election, even in a Democratic-leaning state like Maryland. So, Bill Kristol, what happened in Maryland last night?
You know, sometimes it's especially in the Democratic states that the Republican base gets more radical. It's smaller, right? So in a certain way, it's less concerned with winning. So sometimes that's a bit of a check, though it hasn't been in states like Pennsylvania. It doesn't look like it's going to be in Wisconsin. But in some places, it checks the craziness, whereas here they can indulge in it because they probably don't win anyway. But to dot the I and cross the T on that, because it's even – could he make the point even more strongly? Why did Cox win? He was endorsed by Trump. The person who lost was a cabinet member of Governor Hogan's administration, a two-term Republican administration that was pretty successful.
Immensely popular.
And popular in Maryland. Yeah. Governor Hogan supported her, campaigned for her, and couldn't. And she's a very, you know, respectable candidate. I would say there were no obvious, you know, red flags or anything. And she couldn't win. So it shows how radicalized the base is. And look how powerful Trump remains with the base. No way Cox wins without Trump's endorsement.
And in Wisconsin, I mentioned this earlier, my home state of Wisconsin, we learned yesterday, I think, that Donald Trump actually called up the Republican Speaker of the State Assembly, Robin Voss, to pressure him to decertify the 2020 election. There was a Supreme Court ruling here that said that they improperly used drop boxes. This is, you know, after the fact. And so, and Trump actually wants the Republicans to decertify the electoral votes from Wisconsin from the 2020 election. Robin Voss, who has done everything he can, really, to kiss up to Trump, is obviously not going to do that because it's unconstitutional. But today, Trump is doubling down on this, putting out a statement on what is it, Truth Social or whatever. So what's Speaker Robin Voss doing on the great Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling declaring hundreds of thousands of Dropbox votes to be illegal? This is not a time for him to hide, but a time to act. I don't know his opponent in the upcoming primary, but feel certain he will do well if Speaker Voss doesn't move with gusto. Robin, don't let the voters of Wisconsin down. So here you have the former president of the United States taking, I think, literally the most insane position you could take, asking Wisconsin Republicans to take back votes from an election that took place nearly 2 years ago. I mean, it's one thing to say that Trump is engaging in a big lie. I just kind of want to underline the fact that if you make a continuum of just the nuttiest possible positions on the election, Trump is always the captain and the quarterback of Team Crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, which one hopes, one expects at some point that we pay some price for that. Just on that Wisconsin Supreme Court opinion, as I understand, it was 4-3, it was controversial, yeah, whether it was right or not, that they shouldn't have gone ahead with the drop boxes as a way of handling the pandemic emergency and the need to let people vote remotely, so to speak, or early and also, you know, safely. But no one has questioned the actual, they were real people who cast real votes. If the drop boxes hadn't been there, they would have gone to the polling place and cast the votes or to the, you know, community center and not done it through a drop box. That was a convenience. Maybe the court shouldn't have allowed it, or the administration in Wisconsin, the executive branch shouldn't have allowed it without legislation enabling it. That's, I guess, what the court decided. And therefore, going forward, as at least based on current law, there won't be those kinds of drop boxes. But there's no charge of actual fraud or impropriety. There's just a kind of complicated an issue of how much executive discretion, in a sense, they had in administering the elections under the cloud of the pandemic. So Trump is, of course, lying about what the court said, and then asking for the impossible, I guess. You're there. I mean, do any of the three Republican gubernatorial candidates, are they denouncing Trump's intervention here? Are they defending the Speaker of the House?
No, my guess is that they're all going to be in the tall grass about all of that. I mean, it's sort of like different, as my fellow cheesehead Bill Leaders writes in The Bulwark, it's kind of an embarrassment of riches. Just, you know, which flavor of delusional denialism do you want? Radicalism do you want here? You know, it is interesting the way that Trump has zeroed in on Speaker Robin Voss. This, I think, goes back to the sort of the reptilian instinct that Trump has, that he senses weakness and he looks at Robin Voss and he says, this is somebody who is weak that I can bully because he's sucked up to me in the past. You know, he ran down to, was it Alabama, to attend a game with him, to kiss Trump's ring. Voss is one of those establishment Republicans that thinks you can, you know, toss a little bit of red meat to the baby alligator and it not grow up and eat you. So he's bankrolled this completely bogus investigation that's turned into a complete joke with a former Supreme Court justice who has repeatedly beclowned himself. And he's done this because he thought this would appease the Trumpist radicalized base. And all it's done is energize them and basically put a big target on his back that he's a wimp. And Trump sees him as a wimp, and therefore is going to continue to beat up on him. I mean, this is the instinct of the bully. And so I think it's going to go on. Will it have any effect? No. But just to underline your point, there's no evidence whatsoever that any of those drop boxes contained invalid or fraudulent votes in any way. That's number one. Number two, the Supreme Court ruling, there's a lot of language that's quite deplorable in it. But basically what it said was that in order to make this change, you couldn't just do it through the non-elected Wisconsin Election Commission, that the legislature needed to take action. So that's sort of a separation of powers issue. It does not invalidate the election in any way whatsoever in Wisconsin.
But also, speaking of Republican speakers of the House, a few hundred miles from you in Arizona, Rusty Bowers.
Get to that.
Yeah, okay, well, good. That's, I mean, it's striking, right? I mean, he testified under oath before the January 6th committee quite memorably. Said afterwards and said that he might still vote for Trump again. You and I criticized him for that, I believe, and he sort of backed off a little from that. But anyway, testified under oath as to factual things that had happened between November 3rd and January 6th. No one has challenged a single, to my knowledge, fact that he cited, conversation that he testified about. It wasn't an opinionated testimony. It was a very restrained one, actually, quite fact-based. And so he testified under oath. And for that, he's been censured by the Arizona Republican Party. I mean, And he's the Speaker of the House in Arizona, and he's a respected figure and a quite conservative figure, incidentally. He went along with a lot of stuff that you and I wouldn't have, I think, over the last few years, sure. But whatever. I mean, that just, again, shows the degree, the depth of radicalization in these parties now in Maryland and Wisconsin and Arizona. Yeah, it's not getting better, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about, you know, that and what happened in Maryland, Wisconsin, Arizona. You have Herschel Walker down in Georgia. You have Eric Greitens in Missouri. You have Blake Masters, also in Arizona. It just keeps going on and on and on. But this story the Rusty Bauer story, I mean, as you point out, the Arizona GOP Executive Committee formally censured him, saying that he is, quote, no longer a Republican in good standing. In case there was any doubt about what happens when you tell the truth, what happens when you stand on principle, you are excommunicated. So, you know, this wasn't an expulsion. It, you know, it doesn't obviously do anything. But and again, so Kelly Ward is the chairman down in the Republican Party in Arizona, who is a complete nut job. And the reasons for the censure included Bauer's support of a bill giving taxpayer-funded in-state tuition to migrants, his support for billion-dollar education spending bill, none of which has anything to do with why they actually censured him. They censured him because he testified. Which brings us to the January 6th committee. Big hearing tomorrow night, prime time, connecting the dots, filling in the blanks about what happened on January 6th, making the case that the president of the United States, who takes an oath to see that the laws are faithfully executed, in fact, was guilty of a dereliction of duty. So, Bill, there's a very interesting analysis in Politico suggesting that, you know, the conventional wisdom about the committee was that, you know, no single revelation was going to change Republican minds about Donald Trump. But what happened instead, David Siders writes, is a slow drip of negative coverage, and that may be just as damaging to the former president. 6 weeks into the committee's public hearing schedule, an emerging consensus is forming in Republican Party circles, including in Trump's orbit, that a significant portion of the rank and file may be tiring of the nonstop series of revelations about Trump. The fatigue is evident in public polling and in focus groups, and then he cites our colleague Sarah Longwell's focus groups, where she finds a group of Trump voters unanimous in saying, yeah, we'd like to move on. So give me your sense of the impact so far of the January 6th hearings, whether or not this is wish casting to say that it's causing Trump fatigue.
I think it's causing some Trump fatigue and some people who, I mean, God knows they should have known all this already, but the details stick in a way, perhaps, that the more general judgment doesn't. And when it's Bill Barr saying that the guy was delusional and not you or me or even Liz Cheney in a speech, or certainly not Democrats, that helps. It seems to have, I think, hurt him some with Republican donors and elites. I think the polling suggested sort of among college-educated Republicans. Having said all that, it's knocked him down from what, 60% to 50%, basically, in the polls as the first choice for 2024. It's knocked his favorable down from, you know, 80% to 70%, or probably even higher, 85 to 75, something like that, which is not nothing and matters if you're Ron DeSantis plotting your challenge to Trump. But I mean, in a way, it's unbelievable that he's still as high as he is. But I do think the committee's been important. A, it's just important to get the truth out, obviously, about what happened. And B, it has shown that, you know, it's been an example of actually a competent execution of responsibility of Congress, which is kind of good for the country to see that. Congress has failed so often, and all the parts of government fail so often. Secret Service, places one might have had somewhat high opinion of, turn out to be not great. To see something working well and people behaving honorably and intelligently in carrying out their duties is a good thing. And I say that with particular reference to Liz Cheney, obviously, I guess. But I also, you and I discussed this a bit before, Speaker Pelosi putting Liz Cheney in such a prominent role. That's not an obvious thing to do. She took grief from her members for doing it. I was on a call with someone, some staff people from the 1-6 committee, and they won't talk about this kind of thing at all. But I was joking about, hey, did you ever have any problems with any of the Democrats saying, hey, how come she's the star of this? You know, she's kind of late to the party here. And, you know, and some of these Democrats were pretty impressive in the impeachments and so forth, and are intelligent people. And, you know, the discipline there has been impressive. So for all the partisanship, there's a little bit of a, there's some willingness here to say, you know, what's best for the country, what's best for the bringing out the truth. And I think the witnesses also, including Rusty Bowers from Arizona and others who, you know, of course, Cassidy Hutchinson, we'll see Matt Pottinger tomorrow night and Sarah Matthews. So I think it's the 1-6 committee hearing has been good for the country beyond the sort of eroding Trump's support a bit in the Republican Party.
Well, I agree with all of that. So you dropped something that we'll come back to the committee in just a moment, but I didn't want to gloss over, you know, the emerging story about the Secret Service text messages, which I find to be gobsmacking on so many levels, that the Secret Service now is acknowledging that it deleted all of these text messages after they were requested. Look, taking a deep breath here, I'm trying to think of an innocent explanation for this. And I have to tell you, Bill, I'm coming up short.
No,
This just seems like a disgraceful episode in Secret Service history. Disgraceful.
And I think one can judge it based on what we now know, purposeful, at least at some level among some people. The way in which they ask people to deal with it, well, we're turning over changing our phones or whatever. So all you agents, these are, you know, people who work hard and are very busy and have a zillion of these text messages. You can imagine what it's like to be a Secret Service agent. I mean, leaving aside Trump, just in life in general, right? It's that we're 5 minutes early. I mean, there must be, you know, tens of thousands of them if they're communicating by text a fair amount of the time. You know, take a look, you know, make sure we may go visit this ice cream place. So, you know, we need security there. I was in the White House. I know what that's like. And it used to, a lot of it's done, obviously, mm-hmm. by people speaking into those earpieces that we're so familiar with seeing Secret Service agents wear. But a lot of it these days, I imagine, is done by text. So there are a zillion of these things. And they seem to have, if I'm not mistaken, on January 25th, told the agents, you guys have responsibility to go through and save the ones that are relevant and upload them by January 27th. I think that's right. Which is nuts. Obviously, who has time to do that? If you ask people to do that, they're just going to assume it's not serious. I mean, you and I have been in corporate settings where things had to be preserved or were asked to be preserved, or unfortunately been in one or two even legal situations where that was the case. And if you know what, you know how you do that if you're this U.S. Secret Service? You tell the agents, you bring your phone here. We will have experts who will go over the phone with you, or even you just leave it there and transfer your text messages to a safe, you know, server somewhere. And then you can have your phone back, you know, 2 days later or 2 hours later, you know, however it works. But the idea that they just ask the agents, hey, you know, you're busy, you're on an 8-hour shift tomorrow, but hey, would you please go over these messages and upload them to some server? I wouldn't know how to do that, right?
Yeah.
But instructions are available if you waste, you know, have another 2 hours to waste going online. It's ludicrous. And they didn't intend to save them, in my opinion. And it's really, I agree, it's really shocking.
Our colleague Amanda Carpenter sent me a note for my Morning Shots newsletter. We now know that the migration didn't start until January 27th, which is after multiple congressional committees made explicit requests to preserve such records. Absurdly, the Secret Service still insists it properly reviewed and turned over all relevant documents, including the ones the agency disappeared. And she says that sounds unbelievable in the truest sense of the word. I completely agree with her there. Okay, so back to the 1-6 committee. I think one of the things that they have done, and again, it's maybe people take some of this for granted. I agree with you about, you know, Nancy Pelosi's decision to give such a leading role to Liz Cheney and to Adam Kinzinger, who's going to be, you know, having his star turn tomorrow night. But also the fact that it feels like all of the witnesses, with the exception of some of the law enforcement officers and one filmmaker, they're all Republicans, either elected Republicans, appointed Republicans, many of them within Trump world. Tomorrow night, we're going to hear from Matt Pottinger, who was national security aide for all 4 years of the Trump administration, right up till January 6th, Sarah Matthews, who is, you know, a flack, you know, in the White House. So these are Trump's people. And I think that has been one of the most powerful things, that the call is coming from inside the House. These were all of the folks from the Department of Justice who testified were, you know, Trump-era appointees. Bill Barr, the ultimate Trump loyalist. I do think that that's been powerful. The other thing that people like us need to remember is that we pay lots of attention to this stuff. But when you have something on primetime television, things that you and I may have been talking about for a year and a half will be new to millions of Americans. And that's not nothing. That is significant. So I do think the cumulative weight comes up. But on the question of whether or not the Trump fatigue has been setting in, and you cited some of the poll numbers. We have the poll out of Florida, which shows DeSantis handily beating Trump in his home state. It is his home state, but there's another poll out of Michigan showing DeSantis within the margin of error. We're now getting, you know, reports that Glenn Youngkin, who has been the governor of Virginia for about 5 minutes, is making moves. So, I mean, clearly there's something going on there. So I guess the question comes down to, you know, Trump may be weak, but somebody's got to take him on. And it's got to be a one-on-one, because if it's a crowded field, it's going to be 2016 all over again. So what do you think? Who takes him on? Does DeSantis blink or does he pull the trigger, to use two cliches in a row?
I think people will take him out. I thought that even months ago, because I just think it's, if you're an ambitious politician and you don't pass up a moment, and you don't know where Trump will be a year from now, even if leaving aside the 1-6 committee, right? If you're making a decision at the end of 2022. So I think DeSantis goes. I wouldn't be surprised if Youngkin runs. He thinks there's a lane of being a little less harsh than DeSantis. And also, we just have so much experience. You're in Wisconsin, Scott Walker in 2015, people who are very well-regarded governors, yeah, and, you know, genuinely have a lot of support and raise $30 million or something, and then they just kind of blow up on the launch pad,
anywhere, right?
To use another, whatever.
President John Conley.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it would be prudent, and Youngkin's one term limited in Virginia. So I don't think it's foolish for these people from their point of view to run. You'll antagonize the Trump people forever. I'm not so sure about that. They run, and they're polite to Trump. They just sort of say, it's time for a change. I think I could win a little more easily. Some of them will be less polite if they're on the Liz Cheney sort of side of the spectrum. But Christie will run as the slightly less more willing to challenge Trump than the Youngkin, who will be slightly more willing to be different from Trump than DeSantis, and Tom Cotton or someone who actually voted to uphold January 6th. I think it'll be a multi-candidate race. The question of whether, as you say, they then narrow the field in 2023 so that it actually is a little more like a one-on-one in 2024 is, I think, a very interesting question. And I think there's sort of, that may happen more naturally this time than it did in 2015-16, where Trump was an outsider challenger. There wasn't the same sense of, just the way the, when you're taking on Hillary Clinton in 2015-16 for the Democrats, the field did narrow to one alternative. This was pretty clear you couldn't split the non-Clinton vote. So I think that could happen. And so I think Trump will have a real race. I mean, I'd still think he's the favorite, but a lot can change. Also, the one thing I'd also mention is I do think November 2022 matters. I mean, we're going to have an election to which a lot of people are going to focus on. You know, if DeSantis wins by 7 points in Florida, that will help donors and others say, look, he really is a better bet than Trump. I mean, Trump won by 3. If DeSantis ends up in a closer race than people expect, which I think is possible in Florida, and it's 2 or 3, I think if you think, well, really, is DeSantis any better than Trump? I mean, as a candidate, and a lot of the appeal here isn't a substantive appeal against Trump. It's an electability appeal. So I think a fair amount depends on some of what happens. And if Trumpism looks like it's politically problematic in 2020, if the most radical Trump-endorsed candidates go down in states where it looked like they might win, I think that does help the non-Trump candidates in 2024.
So, and I agree with your analysis here, and I'm guessing that Donald Trump is saying the same things, which is one of the reasons why he might get in early to prevent that, that kind of a crowded field. It also might be one of the reasons why he might hesitate, because as we both know, the one great fear that Donald Trump has that overwhelms everything else is a fear of actually losing. If he thinks he might lose, so what do you think he's going to do? What timeline are you looking at?
I think he's very likely to run, and I think he's likely to announce, soon and Labor Day-ish. I think it makes sense from his point of view. It does probably freeze the others a little bit. It makes people more hesitant. That means if you're getting in, you're getting it against him. DeSantis doesn't get to say on November 15th what he could say if Trump was still making up his mind, which is, well, we don't know who the field's going to be, but I think I've just been reelected in Florida. I think I have something to say to the nation, and I'm planning on running, or mm-hmm. thinking of running, and Youngkin does the same, and Christie and everyone else. If Trump's already announced, it's a little harder. Then you're saying, mm-hmm. I'm running against Trump. So I think it's in Trump's personal interest, may not be in the Republican Party's interest, to announce early. And look, most of what's going to happen in November is going to happen anyway, based on other kinds of trends and factors. And Trump probably figures you might as well take credit for the good stuff that happens. He get blamed for the bad stuff anyway, by people who want to blame him. So I think Trump's personal self-interest, which is kind of the key to his actions, will lead him to announce in September, which incidentally is another big wild card for what happens in this November, though, because Trump will be more on the ballot than Biden in some ironic way, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, or could be at least, and that would affect things. So an awful lot. This is a very unusual off-year election in that respect. Sure, that's why I don't quite buy the conventional, well, we always know that in the first off-year, this happens, this tends to happen, history suggests. We've never had a situation like this with Trump lurking and maybe announcing with the Republicans nominating the kind of candidates they're nominating, with Liz Cheney probably going down to a defeat in August, which I think will, if she does lose, which will sort of cement in a lot of swing voters' minds the notion of how radical the party's gone. It's one thing to nominate Mastroianni, whatever his name is, in Pennsylvania, or this guy Cox in Maryland, or we'll see what happens in Arizona, and maybe Greitens. That will all add up. But then sort of also repudiating Cheney, it just puts kind of the dots that I, so to speak, crosses that T about what kind of Republican Party we're facing. And I think the combination of all this, yeah, puts Trump on the ballot and Trumpism on the ballot in this off-year election as much as it puts the incumbent Democratic administration or even the incumbent democratically controlled Congress on the ballot.
And you also have another factor, which is the crazy factor, which you talked about with Joe Trippi last week. And we're also seeing something kind of interesting happening in the Senate races. Axios reporting this morning, Democrats across the 10 most competitive Senate races are outraising Republicans by more than $75 million among small dollar donors, those giving less than $200. So this is kind of interesting that you're seeing this kind of surge. And of course, the Republicans have lots of problematic candidates in swing states. Herschel Walker, Eric Greitens, Blake Masters in Arizona, Eric Greitens in Missouri. And, you know, Axios looks at this and goes, the big picture here is that Trump-induced donor fatigue and other factors are impacting the GOP grassroots, prompting Republican candidates to rely more heavily on high-dollar donors. But this would also be a suggestion, just one of those indicators that even though, you know, the conventional wisdom is that Republicans are far more motivated this year than Democrats, that's not true among small dollar donors. So does this actually matter?
Who are pretty good, have been in the past, a decent leading indicator sometimes of turnout and stuff. No, I think Democrats may by now, partly because of also Roe v. Wade and stuff, be as motivated as Republicans and the extremism in general. You know, someone else pointed out, I can't remember what article it was this morning, that incidentally, who's getting a lot of these small dollar donations on the right? Donald Trump and his various entities.
Right. He's hoovering up the money. Right?
He is. You know? He's not spending it for any of these candidates. So if you're a Democrat, I think you should, you know, it's like encourage them, give a lot of money to Trump. Just don't give money to actual candidates who are on the ballot in 2022.
Well, I think it's interesting, the Axios analysis, a concerted Republican effort to build a small dollar fundraising apparatus independent of Trump's brand appears to be faltering. Well, Democrats are building on the massive grassroots financial success they saw in 2020. Okay, so speaking of Democrats, on this podcast, we have frequently beat up on Democrats for being bad at politics, for stumbling and bumbling, or perhaps being tone deaf. But our colleague Tim Miller makes a really good case, I think, in my Morning Shots newsletter that the House vote yesterday to codify, same-sex marriage and interracial marriage was smart politicking. He said, for some reason, the Democrats have spent much of the last 19 months, you know, fighting among themselves. But that wasn't the case yesterday when the House voted to codify the right to marry for gay couples. Every Democrat voted in favor. Only 47 Republicans supported the bill, 157 apparently believing that his marriage should be, you know, possibly be revoked by the state, so much for freedom. And the case Tim is making is the politics and the policy align perfectly for Democrats. If Chuck Schumer brings the bill up, it may very well attract 10 Republican votes, giving President Biden a big worthwhile win. If it falls short, the Democrats will have another campaign issue to use targeting suburban swing voters and apathetic young voters. And the House vote's already providing some political opportunity for Senate Democrats. I mean, among the no votes on gay marriage was Congressman Ted Budd, the Republican nominee for Senate in North Carolina. So he's now on record with a vote that's going to allow the state of North Carolina to annul gay marriages. And that is not a winner, he writes, in Charlotte. Let me tell you, you know, it won't be the number one voting issue in North Carolina, but it could be part of a broader campaign to demonstrate how radical the GOP is. And he says, look, this is an interesting template. I mean, imagine if Democrats expanded the same notion across a host of issues, you know, codifying Lawrence, which said you can't criminalize private sexual acts, guaranteed access to contraception, a right to abortion in the case of rape and incest, a ban on semi-automatic firearms for people under 21, prescription drug prices. How about the Mike Pence Memorial Act of 2022, mm-hmm. clarifying the vice president has no role in overturning an election? Now, would they get 60 votes in the Senate? Maybe. Would Republicans look insane, more insane, if they blocked all of them? Yes, they would. So your thoughts on this, Bill?
I mean, it's always almost always good to split the other party if you can keep your party together. And I think that happened in the House. It's been amazing how few times it's happened in the last year and a half. There were other opportunities to do it. But the Democrats talked themselves into packaging everything to these massive bills, which then allowed the Republicans to pick the worst part of the bill, the one thing they did, and to say, well, we can't be for that. But I think Speaker Pelosi has intelligently, finally, maybe, but this was like, she's always been smarter about this, honestly, than the Senate Democratic leadership, you know, pick individual items and let's have a high profile vote on Wednesday on this, and let's do contraception on Tuesday on marriage. Let's do contraception on Thursday. Let's not just have one giant bill, which you can pick the weakest part of and oppose. So I do think this is an important moment. I'm very struck by what Tim says about North Carolina. Tom Tillis, the incumbent Republican senator who's not up for re-election this year in North Carolina, said he was inclined to vote for the protection for same-sex and interracial marriage, for that matter, if it comes to the floor of the Senate. That will be interesting because Bud had voted against it in the House. And so, you know, the Democratic candidate in North Carolina can say, hey, look, even this Republican, even the incumbent Republican senator of North Carolina voted for it. In Utah, all the Republican members of Congress voted for it. Seems to me that Evan McMullen, who's running an interesting independent race against Mike Lee, and the Democrats stepped down. So he has kind of some chance to get pretty close at least. Well, he is pretty close. I think he has some chance to win. I don't know, honestly, if the citizenry of Utah is on board with these days with same-sex marriage, but all the Republican members voted for it. Mike Lee will presumably be against it. So Evan McMullen can say, look, I'm here with these Republican members of Congress you just elected and thinking this is a good idea to codify what has in fact been the law of the land for 7 years. And Mike Lee's the one who's the extremist and being against it. So I do think it opens up political opportunities. They should do it on a whole bunch of other issues. And maybe they will. I, of course, was then very distressed to see Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat in the Senate, who's a pretty shrewd political guy usually, I think, saying, oh, well, I'm not sure we can get to that. We've got to go on recess, you know, we've got a lot of things to accomplish. I mean, really, I mean, how Schumer and Durbin, I've got to say, who are intelligent people, and I know them both, and I actually respect them as individuals, have just not been very effective politically. It's tough in a 50-50 Senate, I agree with that, but I'm just struck by their, I don't know, they just don't seem to be thinking about this in a politically intelligent way. And it's not like anyone's asking them to abandon their principles. They believe in this. So, I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not like this is something contrary that they're supposed to do. This is the right thing to do from their point of view, certainly. And they're still sort of hesitant about doing it. I can't really understand that. And then saying publicly, well, the reason is we have to have a five-week, I think is what's currently scheduled, break in August. Really? I think most Americans look at that and think, you know what, maybe you could take a 3 or 4 week break or 1 or 2 week break like the rest of us do, you know?
Yeah, when you say out loud that your top priority is the oh-so-critical August recess, that's just like, what? I mean, look around you. I mean, there are things that are actually going on. No, I mean, to reiterate what you just said, though, there was this early addiction on the part of the Democratic leaders to these omnibus bills that were just packed with all kinds of things that, you know, at the end of the day, nobody really knew what was in them. They were packed so tight with some good ideas and some horrendous ideas that they were dead on arrival, as opposed to, you know, these very, very clear votes. You know, have a big vote on, you know, reproductive rights, or you could say, let's have an up or down vote on the right to abortion in the case of rape or incest. Make people go on the record. Split your opposition. Guaranteed access to contraception. That's why this was so smart. There was actually an interesting take in the Washington Post as well about this. So you and I are both old enough to remember when a decade ago, when the Democratic vice president, who was then Joe Biden, got ridiculed for an alleged gaffe for saying he supported gay marriage. And Republicans had used gay marriage as a wedge issue against Democrats. Well, what happened yesterday was, you know, a reversal, you know, a switch in the polarities, because yesterday Democrats used gay marriage to divide the Republicans, splintering them on the issue. So we have gone from a decade ago where Republicans thought this is a great issue for us, we will embarrass and split Democrats, to now Democrats are completely united on it, and it is Republicans who are splintering, and Republicans would have to take the embarrassing votes. Also, I think the legitimacy of this vote is underlined not just by Justice Thomas's concurring opinion, where he says, you know, if we don't recognize a right to privacy in the Constitution for abortion, then we ought to use the same logic to overturn all of these other things. And then you have Ted Cruz, who comes out and says, yeah, Obergefell was an overreach by the court. And so they are saying it explicitly that this would be their agenda, that they would overturn this. And again, it would be gross political malpractice for Democrats not to take them at their word and not to show a certain amount of urgency about this, right?
So. Yeah, urgency is what's been lacking in certain ways. And again, the ones who are most urgent sometimes are the furthest left, which they're entitled to be, but their policies aren't wise usually or popular often. Whereas here, you get some urgency for what's a pretty much a consensus position in the nation now, and obviously one that the court imposed, you might say, or ratified 7 years ago. It already had become the case in many states, of course, and now is on the ballot. I don't know. You're in Wisconsin. That's a fairly socially conservative state, but I don't know. Is it obvious that Ron Johnson is on the right side of that? I guess he'll vote against same-sex marriage, but I don't know. There are a lot of swing voters in Milwaukee suburbs who probably think that's, you know, like it's been the law for 7 years. Whatever you thought about that decision as a matter of jurisprudence, we now have it everywhere in the country. The country's not falling apart. Families are not being damaged by the fact that some of those families now are same-sex marriages. And I don't know. It feels to me like it's not an easy vote for these Republican senators.
Well, exactly. And let's go back to the idea of cumulative effect. So you can, you know, some of the smart kids are pointing out that, you know, abortion is not the number one issue. Abortion is not necessarily going to move as many votes as Democrats would hope. And they're probably right about that. But it's the cumulative effect of all of these culture war issues that I think will have an effect or could have an effect, you know, in places like Madison and the suburbs of Milwaukee, where it's not just an up or down vote on abortion. Because, I mean, really, quite frankly, here in Wisconsin, it becomes a binary choice. You know, Republicans will make sure that abortion is banned. There's already a law on the book. Democrats, I think, will push back. Well, I mean, will push back against that. But same thing with gay marriage. So the cumulative effect, you have the right to contraception, the right to abortion, whether or not you are going to, you know, the possibility of annulling gay marriages. All of these things stacked up together, I think, will make a difference and do make it more problematic for somebody like Ron Johnson, who is problematic to begin with. But again, and I'm sorry to be kind of a broken record on this, a lot depends on who the Democrats choose to run against him. These are choices. They're not up or down referendums.
No, and precisely because the Democrats correctly, I think, have moved over to understanding that they have much better chance making these choices in individual states rather than a referendum on the Biden administration, since Biden's, you know, God knows, 35% approval in Wisconsin, whereas these, you know, the actual races for governor and senator are more like 50, you know, or close to 50-50 right now, it looks like, and Johnson's not very popular. It becomes more important who you nominate, right? You can't prosecute the extremism argument very well if you yourself have a lot of stuff on record that a lot of voters look at and think, well, that's kind of extreme on the other side. So maybe I'll just, you know, stick with the Mitch McConnell Republicans in my vote here for the Senate. So I think it's been very helpful to the Democrats to nominate mostly moderate or, yeah. I mean, Fetterman's more complicated figure, but even he's not a sort of caricature of a lefty Dem, you know.
Well, yes.
It's statewide.
And that is the danger here, yeah.
Yeah, but I think it seems to be the danger in Wisconsin, where Mandela Barnes just has a lot of stuff on record, which I think he sincerely believes and is a decent person and all that, but it's not quite where Wisconsin voters are.
No, and Ron Johnson is not backing off from some of the crazy stuff, although I will say that the airwaves, it's all inflation, it's all crime, it's all the border all the time. Here in Wisconsin. Bill Kristol, once again, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. We will talk again soon.
My pleasure, Charlie.
The Bulwark Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio production by Jonathan Siri. I'm Charlie Sykes. Thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast, and we'll be back tomorrow. We'll do this all over again.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. LifeLock is here with tips to help protect your identity. Use strong passwords, set up multi-factor authentication, report scams, and update your software. And for comprehensive identity protection, LifeLock is your best choice. LifeLock alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information and fixes identity theft, guaranteed, or your money back. Start your protection today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use promo code NEWS. Terms apply.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda salutes those who've served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of Coda's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use Coda Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on Coda. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.